It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com.
Well, the world is turning on its head. That, according to Kathleen Gaffney, co-director of Diversified Fixed Income at Eaton Vance, who joins us here in our 1130 studios. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us. So I want to start with this idea that the developing markets are emerging much more quickly and faster and growing faster than developed world, which are kind of sinking. Does this mean that you like emerging markets high yield debt over U.S. junk bonds?
I do. Selectively, we're finding good opportunities to invest in emerging market companies, and a handful of them are below investment grade, but rising stars, likely to make their way onto the global stage and become investment grade down the road.
Can you just give us some examples so that we understand exactly the kinds of companies you're talking about?
Well, our focus has been primarily in Latin America.
America Movil, I know, is one of the holdings in your fund.
It is. Mexican telecom, but higher quality. I'm talking about some of the Brazilian companies, and Suzano is a good example. Paper and pulp company. Low-cost producer, number one. They came to market earlier this year at very attractive spreads. That was right after the new administration, and there was a lot of fear about protectionism. We saw a fair amount of new issuance that had to come with a premium. And what's interesting in talking to management, what we saw was discipline and a drive to maintain that low-cost status, but without levering up.
So I'm wondering, you know, a lot of people have been pouring money into emerging markets, debt, as well as currencies. And this could be what's been happening with the dollar earlier this year, with the dollar weakening and emerging markets currencies really strengthening. Recently, it's been the reverse. You've seen some dollar strength. And do you think that that will continue, that the dollar will continue to strengthen as benchmark yields rise? And what's the potential consequence for emerging markets?
In the near term, I think you are going to see some dollar strength. The global economy is doing well, but the focus is on the U.S. and the unwind of the balance sheet. So we've seen yields start to move up, and the U.S. is leading. That is going to draw money into the U.S. and push the dollar higher in the short term. That won't be so much of a problem for emerging markets if they have a fair amount of reserves. They got into a lot of trouble back in 2013 when they didn't have the dollar reserves as the dollar strengthened. That's changed a lot.
Yeah, there have been a pretty big buildup in reserves. I have to wonder, though, you're talking about how yields should continue to rise or have been rising in the U.S. And earlier this week, Jeffrey Gundlach of DoubleLine said that the Treasury market was facing its moment of truth as yields in the 10-year Treasury surpassed 2.4%. Do you agree? And how high could this yield go?
I do agree. And how high it goes? Probably not too high in the near term. But the important part for the markets is that it started. And we're seeing the impact of that today. We're seeing it with some equities on the retail side. Mattel cut their dividend. One of the trends during the period after the global financial crisis is companies haven't invested. What they've done is they have borrowed and they've been buying back their stocks. A dividend cut, and we're seeing lots of interesting things this earnings cycle, could indicate that they're concerned about where their cash is and the amount of debt relative to revenues, or their interest expense, I should say. That's a warning sign. That's a signal.
Do you think that there's a warning sign when it comes to high-yield debt in general?
Well, credit spreads are very tight. You could argue that on a relative basis, they could get tighter, but it's that absolute level of risk. At 4%, you're not getting compensated for a highly levered company.
So if you are invested in that particular kind of company and situation, what would you suggest to people?
I really think you have to define credit risk, high yield, more broadly. That's why we found value in emerging markets, because you're able to pick up some additional yield to compensate you for the credit risk. You can also look at the bank loan market, convertible market. There are other ways to get that credit exposure other than just U.S. high yield. And European high yield, the yields are even worse than in the U.S. So it's a struggle. Our high yield exposure is fairly modest right now.
Kathleen, do you think that there are certain industries within the U.S. high-yield universe that are on the precipice of a pretty big fall?
We're seeing pressure today, that's for sure.
But which do you think is real? Which do you think has legs?
I do think that the pressure on the retail sector is real.
And it's going to continue because there's already been a lot of pain there.
There has been a lot of pain. What's interesting is we're seeing how companies are reacting. So at the higher quality end, you see CVS and Aetna, but all of it is a result of the world is changing. We've got a new economy. Tech is really driving it. And it's going to make for some necessary decisions across industries.
Thank you for coming in and spending time with us. Kathleen Gaffney is the co-director of Diversified Fixed Income for Eaton Vance and helps to manage over $300 billion of assets based in Boston, of course, home to Bloomberg 1061, Boston Newburyport, and 1330 in Metro West and the South Shore.
It is a huge day in tech shares today. The NASDAQ 100 index is up 2.5%, but Alphabet and Amazon are experiencing much bigger share price pops after beating analyst estimates when they reported earnings after the bell yesterday. Shira Ovide, Bloomberg Gadfly columnist, joins us here now. And Shira, we were joking this morning that the expectation on the street was for 3 cents per share for Amazon, and they beat that. Yay! I mean, how good is this?
Yeah, profit doesn't matter at Amazon. Basically, it defies all the logic of typical investing. My favorite statistic is looking at Amazon's operating profit, which they seem to try to make as low as possible. So the profit margin in this quarter was 0.79%, which is almost as close to zero as possible.
What's the cash flow like?
The cash flow is better, but it's actually that's actually shrinking too. I mean, Amazon has been in this period of intense spending.
But they still had cash flow of more than $7.5 billion last year.
That is correct. Although those, yes.
Okay, and I'm assuming that many people see brown boxes show up at their homes every day.
Many people see brown boxes show up. I mean, look.
And they might actually include medication, prescription medication in the future, plus your order from Whole Foods.
It is possible that Amazon already delivers groceries through Amazon Fresh, but it's likely they're getting more seriously into that business now that they bought Whole Foods.
Okay, so to just step back for a second, it's all about a story, right? I mean, when you invest in a company, particularly when you buy a stock, it's about the story that you can tell investors to get them excited about the future. And that may be why the stock is up 12% today.
Amazon is, I would argue, the most ambitious company, certainly in the technology industry right now. You can make an argument that they're the most ambitious company in the world right now. And the fact is, they are dominating two huge categories of spending, both retail, electronic commerce, where they're basically all the growth in retail spending right now, and also cloud computing, where they've turned this Amazon web business company from zero to $18 billion in annual revenue. And it's really a disruptive force. And groceries, you know, it's $800 billion a year in spending in the U.S. alone.
Well, let's talk about groceries, because they purchased Whole Foods. And Whole Foods is in the industry that typically has low margins, which is grocery stores. And yet it has higher margins than most of Amazon's businesses, including their core business. And meanwhile, their margins went down for Whole Foods as Amazon cut prices. At what point does this matter, that they've gained market share by cutting prices to the point where their margins are razor thin? Is that enough of a strategy to get them to fit their capital structure later on?
Yeah, I mean, I think to Pim's point, it's not really about where the margins are today. It's whether Amazon can leverage its acquisition of Whole Foods to grab a bigger slice of one of the largest spending categories in the world, which is food shopping. And look, if Amazon can become a major player in groceries, that, again, it opens another multi-billion dollar annual revenue opportunity for this company. It's a big question whether they can succeed. They haven't been very successful in groceries for 10 years, but they now have kind of this pretty smart asset to help them get there.
I just keep thinking of one word, Borders. Remember Borders books? Amazon has a way of competing that really has changed the landscape for a variety of industries. That's not news. I think the big question now that people have is, should they add to their holdings? In other words, you described it. The numbers don't really add up in the way that many investors are taught. Yet, the stock keeps moving higher. So is it a trap, or is this, I mean, as long as Jeff Bezos is in charge, I mean, they're buying aircraft, they're launching rockets. I mean, this is an amazing, as you said, this could be the most ambitious company around.
Yeah, I mean, look, this company has a track record of investing in things that seem insane for a long time and then making them into successes. So that's why you're seeing the stock price shoot up, even though they turned in, you know, kind of skinny profits.
I want to bring in David Garrity. He's chief executive officer of GVA Research, which is based in Brooklyn. And David, I want to get your take about whether you would recommend that people buy at this point, given the fact that valuations are already pretty high and it's sort of unclear where they go from here.
I think the thing coming off of the results yesterday for Amazon that probably most impressed investors on the margin is the fact that the integration of Whole Foods was actually profitable in the quarter. The company actually made $21 million on the revenues that Whole Foods contributed. To the extent that Amazon, by extrapolation, can do an effective job of integrating acquisitions onto its platform, we look at the valuation on Amazon stock and we all recoil in shock. But what we have here is a very high-priced currency, which could be used for acquisitions to the extent that Amazon decides to accelerate and take a buy versus build approach into going into new areas. Obviously, we've seen concerns or, you know, possible speculation raised yesterday that Amazon was going to get more significantly involved in the distribution of pharmaceuticals, drugs. Certainly a very high margin, certainly attractive area. And if we're now looking at Amazon as being a company that not only offers very high organic growth, but is an effective acquirer, then we see a possible path here where growth could perhaps even accelerate.
Echo. Tell me about Echo and Alexa.
Well, to the extent that we saw Prime subscriber revenues or subscription revenues rise by 59% year over year, typically, Prime buyers tend to have Alexa, they tend to have Echo, and to that extent, there tends to be more data capture of those higher income households on margin, which certainly means that if we're looking at a world where there is monetization of data as a way to drive shareholder value, it certainly seems that Amazon is clearly in the vanguard, in the forefront, in that area. We may not necessarily be comfortable with it from the standpoint of personal privacy, but investors are obviously very interested in what this says about the company's ability to tailor offerings in the future to consumers.
Real quick, we didn't really get into Google too much, but does this give you a sense, Shira, that they are successful at selling ads and have that pressure, that sort of monopoly at this point?
I mean, look, Google is both growing insanely quickly and has very fat profit margins, and it seems like an impossible combination. They keep hitting it out of the park.
Well, shares of Google are up more than 6.5% right now. Thanks very much, Shira Ovide, our Gadfly columnist when it comes to all things technology. Our thanks also to David Garrity, the chief executive of GVA Research.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Well, everyone may be getting ready for Halloween, and in order to have Halloween, you need costumes and party supplies. And here to help us tell us about the industry is Jim Harrison. He is the chief executive of Party City. They're based in New Jersey, and Jim is in our studio in New York. Jim, thanks very much for being here. I notice you're wearing your orange tie and the black suit. Is that already because you're getting into the holiday spirit here for Halloween?
I've been in the holiday spirit for at least 30 days as we've been building our stores and inventory. And right now, it's getting really hot in the stores. Over the next 6 days, 7% of our retail sales will occur, annual sales will occur in the next 6 days. The interesting thing about our business, that's about half our business is retail, the other half is consumer products. The consumer products business is a lot less lumpy. It's 300 million birthdays in America every year, nice and smooth, and a season or a celebration every month.
So what does your house look like? Describe how you've decorated it.
We've got tombstones, we've got pumpkins, we've got skeletons hanging from trees, we've got lights that go on at night, and a doorbell that plays creepy music.
Wow, you're that family.
You are that family.
Yeah. We are the guy you don't want to live next to, right?
All right, but having said that, let's talk a little bit about the business right now. I mean, the stock has not been doing real well. It's down about 20% so far this year. What have been the challenges and what are you doing?
The biggest challenge we have is really getting our story out. I mean, with our name being Party City, folks put us in a retail box, and they think of us as solely a retailer. And as a result, that retail prism has really created a pallor, if you would, over our stock. Only 25% of our $400 million of EBITDA comes solely from our retail business. 35% on a standalone basis comes from our wholesale business, and then the remainder is the vertical model. Because we provide roughly 80% of what's in our own stores, in that world, we have the ability to make a manufacturing profit, a wholesale profit, and a retail profit. So 80% is what we call either a double or a triple, meaning we have two layers of margin. And of the triples, only 22% of the 80 is actually triples where we manufacture. We have 9 manufacturing plants around the globe. We make costumes. We make our own latex balloons in Malaysia, but we also domestically manufacture lots of product. We have a 60% worldwide market share in metallic balloons. We make those in Minneapolis. We manufacture plates, cups, and napkins here in the United States. We extrude plate cups and bowls up in Rhode Island. We do injection molded plastics down in New Mexico. So we do a lot of manufacturing. So our products go not just to the party industry, but to movie theaters, to sporting arenas, to restaurants and bars and stuff like that.
I'm wondering, does Party City sell goods through Amazon? And, you know, at some point, could you imagine not having a physical brick and mortar store and just focus on the manufacturing?
So that's really two questions. Let me start with the first question.
Okay.
In terms of Amazon, on the party side of the business, our products are generally available on Marketplace. Amazon does not bring in the party goods per se. And if they did, it would be from us because we basically hold all the IP as well as the broadest selection of anybody in the marketplace. In terms of our stores and opening stores, recent surveys have shown this recent season on a number of surveys, anywhere from 60 to 75% of consumers want to go to a store to buy their Halloween goods. 35% will look online for inspiration, but 60+% anywhere from 60 to 75 want to actually go into the stores. And if you think about even Halloween in our business, we're a collection business on the party side. So if you're having a bridal shower, you're going to buy a bunch of stuff, AUR in the $2, got a coordinated icon and imagery, and you're going to make your house festive and decorative. So it's a discretionary purchase, lots of SKUs. On the Halloween side, our point of differentiation is we call it mix it, match it, make it your own. So if you wanted to be Spider Girl, for instance, you could go to Party City and have 20 different Spider Girl outfits that you could construct with all the accessories and separates that we provide. Amazon, other folks on the web, Walmart, they provide costume in a bag. We do costumes in a bag, but it's a relatively small part of our total Halloween offering.
Spider Woman, you think I should do that?
Yes, by all means. I want to know about a purchase that you did recently of a company called Grandmark. And I just so that may sort of offer a way to expand the conversation a little bit.
Sure. So Grandmark is a company in Mexico. They're a distributor. They're essentially very similar to our wholesale business here in the U.S. in terms of going to the broader market. They also have a manufacturing footprint, and it's basically ink on paper. So a lot of products that we currently source from China, a lot of banners, stickers, gift bags, gift wrap, we're actually starting to make ourselves in our own factory in Monterey.
Okay, my quick question there was then the whole trade issue. Are you concerned about any of the issues related to trade, NAFTA, and so on?
It's once again, we're dealing with such a nominal price point that it's not really an issue.
What's the biggest challenge right now for Party City?
The biggest challenge for Party City right now is making sure that we stay ahead of the curve in terms of the consumer. The consumer today, especially the younger consumer, is looking for experiential. And so having a house party is maybe not number one on their list. They want to go to a theater, or they want to go to a restaurant, they want to go on a cruise, they want experience as part of that celebration. So we're building out what we call our alternative markets group to get in front of that curve so that we're going into the cruise ships and into the restaurants and providing the products that will make those celebrations special.
So do you also have people to kind of cultivate what that experience would be for the cruise or for the restaurant or whatever else?
Right. So it comes in a number of different ways. One, in terms of creating environmental decorations, that's kits. In terms of creating a product for the celebrations themselves, creating a suite of products and menus that consumers can go on, select, and then we use our e-commerce capabilities, actually, to ship directly to restaurants or wherever.
Thank you so much for joining us.
And my pleasure.
Send
Thank
us
you.
A picture of your home with some sound effects. Jim Harrison, Chief Executive Officer of Party City, gearing up and has been gearing up for the past 30 days for Halloween. Thank you so much for joining us. Healthcare. CVS Health Corp is reportedly considering a blockbuster buyout of health insurer Aetna, and here to talk about what this deal would mean for the broader healthcare industry, as well as how exactly CVS would pay for this, is Max Neeson. Max Neeson, Bloomberg Gadfly columnist covering all things health related. Max, thank you so much for joining us. So can you give us a sense, first of all, of what the logic is behind this tie-up and how likely it is at this point?
Yeah, so there's kind of a two-part logic to this. The first is generally in healthcare, vertical consolidation has benefits. If CVS, which in addition to running pharmacies is a pharmacy benefit manager, owns an insurer, all of those things that your insurer wants you to do to make your healthcare cheaper, use a mail order pharmacy, go to a cheap clinic instead of the doctor, it can push all of those Aetna enrollees to its businesses. So there's that kind of direct benefit. And there's also the fact that there aren't that many other places for CVS to expand. Express Scripts and United Health already control the vast majority of the pharmacy benefit industry. There's not that much expansion you could do there. And we saw with Walgreens and Rite Aid, you can't buy that many more pharmacies without running into antitrust issues. So it does make sense in that sense.
All right, Max, I'm trying to get my head around this, but at least right now I know that the investors in CVS are not too thrilled about this deal because the stock is down nearly 4%. CVS already has a contract with another insurer, Anthem, correct?
Yeah, so that's something they just signed. Anthem is starting a PBM of its own, but it's letting CVS run a substantial portion of it. That was just a week ago that they signed that, so that's obviously going to be a complicating factor.
Right, and right now, the leverage that a CVS has in order to negotiate drug prices is why? Because they have a lock on business directly tied to whatever the insurance company is that we provide or that you have.
Yeah, so they have a big set of clients, both insurers, also employers that contract with them to negotiate their drug prices. That kind of amalgamation lets them push for lower prices. The way they do that is by having a series of drug lists. So they have a what's called a preferred formulary where they can exclude certain drugs. So they can say, if you don't give us a discount, we're going to push people to your competitor's drug. The more people they have, the more leverage they have in those kind of negotiations.
So this would be a tie-up that would be incredible for their bargaining position. How much is this a defensive move in anticipation of Amazon.com plowing into healthcare, as everybody suspects they will?
I mean, I think it's pretty clearly one, because Amazon is a threat to so many parts of CVS's business. If it gets more directly into medicine, you know, there's the PBM part if Amazon decides to play a role there. There's retail pharmacies. So obviously moving to diversify and having kind of a captive set of clients would really be a benefit for the company, because at the end of the day, Amazon is bigger, better funded, and better at the internet. So they're a threat.
Well, but let's talk a little bit about the funding, right? Because this is not a cheap purchase, which is probably why CVS shares have been falling. And they really don't have the cash to pay for this. So this would be a pretty substantial leveraged buyout, no?
It absolutely would be. I mean, it would definitely have a stock component, but it's unclear how much of that they'll be able to do. It's going to be a significant cash outlay. CVS doesn't have a ton of cash. They already have more than $20 billion in debt. And this deal, based on some of the figures being thrown around, could cost $65, $70 billion. That's close to CVS's market cap. So it's obviously going to be a really big one.
Hey, Max, I wonder if you could just give us an idea of what your thoughts are about the very business model that says if we can put as many individuals and as many corporations in between you and the service or the the service or the product that you're buying, I thought that was going to be done away with because of technology. You get rid of all the middlemen. You go direct to consumer. Why can't that happen? Why can't they do it? Why are they waiting for Amazon to give them the kick?
I mean, it's because being a middleman is extraordinarily profitable.
Yeah, but when you have Amazon breathing down your neck, I mean, we've already been through that in the financial industry. You had, you know, a wide swath of brokers. Now they're advisors because you can't make money, on pennies.
So, I mean, that's kind of the hope of what people that if that's Amazon's hope if they want to get into this business.
Do you see that viable? Do you think that trend is going to happen?
You know, the question is whether Amazon wants another very complicated, low margin business. You know, they have sort of unlimited capacity for it, it seems. So I wouldn't rule it out. The defense that, you know, the wholesalers and PBMs are putting out is that, you know, this is complicated, there are regulatory issues. But, you know, in time, Amazon would be able to figure that out, and its scale will always give it a chance.
I was just going to say, you know, it's interesting. Shares of Amazon today are up 8.5%. Shares of Aetna, down 1.3%. Shares of CVS, down 4%. That kind of tells you something.
Max, really quick, how likely is this to get through?
I'm going to say about 50-50. You know, just the divide between CVS's obvious need and the potential regulatory and funding issues on the other side. So we'll see.
And you're going to be following it for this. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Max Neeson, Bloomberg. I have some insurance claims maybe you can help me with too. Max Neeson, our Gadfly columnist.
Wow, this
when it
devolved.
Comes to healthcare. Indeed.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more. So you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.